From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. On the Tuesday show, as a presidential transition moves ahead, we look at how history is reassessing a past Republican president, George H.W. Bush.
Later, in the wake of the Volkswagen emissions scandal, some car makers are still adamant there's a future for diesel cars here.
Diesels are viable. Turbo diesels are viable as far as both power and gas mileage, and they can be made to run cleanly, which is what VW has promised to do, is if you're going to keep your car, they're going to make it run cleaner now and back to the way it should have been all along.
And the problem with writing a novel featuring futuristic technology is that all too often, the future is now.
What's something that's just a couple of steps ahead? And between the time when I started writing the book and when I wrote the end notes for the book, a couple of the things that I had thought were, 10 years in the future are actually coming to pass.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. Good morning. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. In the final days before the November election, a letter by President George H.W. Bush was widely circulated on the internet and across the traditional media as well. It was a letter he wrote to his successor, Bill Clinton, as Clinton prepared to take up residency in the White House. The letter was a lot of things, gracious, thoughtful, and for a lot of people, surprising.
It showed an eloquent side to the first President Bush that many didn't necessarily associate with him, even those among his supporters. But that eloquence is consistent with the George Bush that surfaces in journalist John Meacham's exhaustive biography of the 41st president. The book is called Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush.
And as we think ahead to the next presidential transition, we'll listen back today to our interview with Meacham, who won the Pulitzer Prize for his biography of Andrew Jackson. We spoke on stage at Boswell Book Company, and Meacham explained what set him on the road to this latest project.
In 1998, when I was a journalist, I went up to Walker's Point in Maine to interview the president with my friend Michael Beschloss, the great historian. Within about 20 minutes, I suddenly understood why 28 years ago, 27 years ago, 54% of the country had decided to entrust their fates to his hands. He gave off this kind of quiet, persistent charisma, not a word you associate with George H.W. Bush. By any means, a sense of command, a sense that things would be safe if he were in charge. And then when you think about it, that's a fundamental political transaction in a democracy, is the capacity to communicate that sense. It's also a form of charm. I had a wonderful teacher once who used to define charm as the capacity to make other people love you without their quite knowing why. And that's a wonderful way of thinking about it, I think. So one of the things biographers are supposed to do is close a gap between public impression and private reality. So my goal here was to try to close the gap that I had experienced in my own life with him. That, and he gave me his diary.
His diary is pretty remarkable. I think we all have this image, or many of us have this image of George H.W. Bush as this sort of, for lack of a better term, waspy guy without a lot.
There's nothing wrong with being a waspy guy.
But your tribe is not necessarily renowned for its being in touch with its feelings to the degree that we see in these diaries.
But that's one of the great surprises about President Bush is exactly that. He was born in 1924. He had a capacity to write incredibly emotional letters, but has a very hard time expressing himself verbally. My grandfather was a lot like this. My grandfather was 11 years older, but couldn't tell you how he felt to save his life, but wrote beautifully about it. And so I think there was something generational about that. The diary itself is an audio diary. So he dictated once, twice, three times a week as president. And one of his views of the office is that no one who is president of the United States should ever complain, never whine. As he put it, you're just damn lucky to be there. Nobody wants to hear the President of the United States say, oh, woe is me. And so what he did with this document is he actually confided in the only person he could safely confide in, himself. Mrs. Bush was surprised by things that were in the diary. 43 was like, what? He said, what? I would take it to his lawyer. I would take it to Jim Baker. I would take it to General Scowcroft, Dick Cheney, Colin Powell. And on occasion, they would say, oh, there's no way that's what the president was thinking. So, yes, I mean, his emotions are vivid. They are, in some ways, they govern him. I think the two things that define him and how he is, even unto this hour, he's in Houston at 92 years old. One was his experience in the war. He was shot down on September 2nd, 1944, over Chichijima, trying to take out a radio tower. He lost two crewmates who were in the plane with him. The cockpit filled with smoke. The wings of the plane went up in flames. He finishes. He drops his payload. He goes back out. He tells his crewmates to hit the silk to bail out. Then he bails out. And if you think about it, when you bail out of an airplane, the plane doesn't stop. And so he goes out, but the tail of the plane keeps moving, and he gashes his head. So another 6 or 8 inches, and that's it. Every day, and today in Houston, he thought about Ted White and Del Delaney, who were the two men who died, whose lives were in his hands. He was 20 years old. He could not vote in 1944. And so, and 2 months before the 1944 presidential election, he won the Distinguished Flying Cross. So it's a sign of how far we've come from that cultural experience. That was one of the many moments he cried when we did these interviews. They were often like the world's worst wasp-on-wasp therapy sessions. He would say, he'd get upset, I'd get upset, then we'd change the subject. But the second thing was the loss of their daughter, Robin, in 1953 to leukemia. She was 4 years old. And the Bushes had never heard the word leukemia until they heard her diagnosis. She survived about 6 months. And biographers have to ask stupid questions. So I said, well, what did that teach you? And he didn't pause. He said that life is unpredictable and fragile. And I think that those two experiences before he was 35 years old with death drove him to his frenetic, constant pace. It's only in the last 4 years that he's sort of slowed down, and that's because Parkinson's put him in a wheelchair. That's what it took. He was so frenetic that once during the 1980 primary campaign, he shook the hand of a department store mannequin in New Hampshire. So, yeah. Lyndon Johnson would have tried to register that mannequin, and God knows what Trump might have done.
There is a letter that he wrote following the death of his daughter that you reprint in this, and I would have you read it, except we would all be crying and we would not be able to get through the rest of the evening. But
it was a political liability. Let's be clear, this is not a case for St. George of Kennebunkport. He was in many ways a transitional political figure, last president of the World War II generation, just as that sacrifice was turning into sentiment as opposed to a genuine appreciation of what they'd done. The media world was changing on him. Bill Clinton knew to go on Arsenio Hall. President Bush thought Arsenio Hall was a building at Yale.
The other thing about his background, you know, we believe, you know, the narrative that exists out there is that he came from this privileged background and that must have given him all of his opportunities. But what you write about it is that he seemed really reluctant to use a lot of those connections, especially early on.
There's no question that George Bush always benefited from being George Bush. His name, George Herbert Walker Bush, he was named after his maternal grandfather, who was a self-made man in St. Louis, G.H. Walker. G.H. Walker and Company still exists. He was an early investment banker, G.H. Walker. His father, Prescott Bush, was the son of the president of Buckeye Steel Castings in Columbus, Ohio. Bush himself, it's very easy to imagine the life he would have had he not gone to Texas in 1948. He would have lived in Greenwich or Larchmont or Rye, where Mrs. Bush came from. He would have worked at Brown Brothers Harriman. He would have worked on Wall Street. He would have played tennis at the River Club. I know 5,000 people like this, and he would have been slightly frustrated. He would have raised money for Republicans, would have been one of those guys steamrolled by the Reagan delegates, because he probably would have been a Rockefeller delegate in 64. But he had a sense of adventure in him, which what has to be innate, because the war broadened his horizons, obviously, but did it broaden his horizons enough to move in the summer of 1948, after being born in Milton, Massachusetts, growing up in Greenwich? He used to joke that his experience of the Depression was they had to reuse tennis balls. So he had grown up in this world. He'd gone to Greenwich Country Day School, Andover, gone to war, come back to Yale, and then in 1948 announces they're moving to Odessa, Texas. And Mrs. Bush's mother thinks that Texas is so remote that she sends boxes of soap and laundry detergent down. So, it's remarkable. But the twin forces always inside him that drove him were service, which is lovely, but also a ferocious, white-hot, consuming ambition. He is one of the most competitive men who ever drew breath. And he doesn't like to talk about it. It took me a year or two to finally get him to say, and he has this big left hand. He said, "What motivates me is goal. Be the captain of the team. Be number one. Whatever it is, be number one." And you marry that to a sense of noblesse oblige or service, and you come up with this man. And it's one of the things I think about the 1%, that's a very interesting question for our world going forward, which is in the 1920s and 30s, you still had the Carnegie idea of the gospel of wealth, which was, you made a lot of money, but then you gave back. And that was Bush's world. Interesting question whether the children of hedge fund people are going to be doing that as well.
Well, and how did he weigh that ambition against ethics or against his conscience, if you will?
Well, he's largely financially scandal-free, which given 60 years in national politics is pretty amazing. His compromises were in the service of amassing power. What redeems him in my eyes as a biographer is not he is guilty of doing things he ought not to have done on the road to power. What makes him worth looking at more seriously, I think, in a deeper way, is that once he had that power, he had a tendency to do things that were against his own political interest. So, two examples. One is he opposed the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Very painful to talk about now, right? That's American scripture. He's running for the Senate. He loses in 64. 1968, he's in the House from Houston. He's the congressman from the 7th District, very conservative district, obviously, to be one of the first Republican districts to go in Texas, to be one of the first districts to go Republican in Texas. And 2 weeks after Dr. King is murdered, a fair housing bill comes up in the House. Bush votes for it. And so he goes back. He has a ferocious meeting at the Memorial High School there in Houston. The crowd is furious with him. They use words that you should not have used then and you cannot use now. We didn't send you up there to help these people, that kind of thing. And he quoted Edmund Burke, and he said, "Sometimes a representative owes you a reflection of your will, but at other times he owes you his best judgment. And my best judgment is that you cannot ask African-American soldiers to go to Vietnam and then say they cannot buy houses in certain neighborhoods." And that was it. He won the crowd. So, and that was a brave vote in the Texas of 1968. The second example is in 1988, he felt he had to consolidate the Republican base. So at the recommendation of Roger Ailes, among others, he said, "Read my lips, no new taxes." He didn't particularly mean it. He didn't particularly think that anybody would take it seriously. That was one of his problems as a politician, is that he believed that campaign rhetoric, he picked up a phrase of Mao's when he was in China, he thought campaign rhetoric were like empty cannons of rhetoric, just like confetti cannons. You shot them off, but nobody got hurt. Problem is that words matter in politics, and you will not have a base with you when the storm comes if they believe that you're not with them. And that's when the Republican right broke with them decisively, led by Newt Gingrich. If you're looking for one of the moments that gave us the world we're in right now, it comes in October of 1990, when Bush is going out to announce the budget compromise that raised taxes with the Democratic leadership to the Rose Garden, and Newt won't go out with them, bolts out the front door of the White House, CNN did a split screen. I think of it as the partisanship O.J. Bronco chase, because that was the moment where reflexive partisanship was being rewarded with publicity and attention. And guess who was out there helping create this alternative universe from the president and the Congress? Rush Limbaugh. Limbaugh went national in 88. He was big enough in 92 that his endorsement of Pat Buchanan in the New Hampshire primary mattered enormously. Buchanan got 40% against Bush in the New Hampshire primary.
What really struck me as I read the section of this book on those years is it has to have been the most eventful one-term presidency in the history of this country.
You and Henry agree. Kissinger said that, too. We start with Tiananmen Square, run through Panama. We have an enormous number of a lot of activity, obviously, on the Soviet front. November 89, the Berlin Wall falls. Classic case of where character is destiny. The empathetic George Bush was not going to go to Berlin and dance on the wall. George Mitchell wanted him to do it. Dick Gephardt wanted him to do it. The press wanted him to do it. He refused. Because if Gorbachev, he believed that if America had suffered a great defeat, the last thing he would need would be the Soviet leader coming and rubbing his face in it. And this is a kid who, in Greenwich, in the old days, he was known as half-half Bush. He would take a treat and cut it in half and give half the candy bar or the cookie to the other kid. One of the key aspects of diplomacy, negotiation of any kind, right, is to put yourself in the other guy's shoes and always give them a face-saving way out. You know, to humiliate China after Tiananmen would feel good in the short run, but wasn't going to do much for the long-term relationship. Gorbachev had a right wing that wanted to return to Soviet glory. I think we have seen in recent years what that is like and how real that fear was. He knew that Gorbachev had a hell of a problem and that he could not make it more difficult. I was privileged once to have lunch with Secretary Gorbachev and President Bush. It was the three of us and his translator, Gorbachev. Gorbachev thought I was the waiter. So I was more vodka, you know. But I watched as he, you know, when you get to be in your 80s and all that, these guys always think it's the last time they're going to see each other, but then they live forever. But anyway, so they were kind of in this mode. They were both in their early 80s. And Gorbachev really teared up talking about how much Bush had meant to him. And this is one of the, you know, go back to August of 1991, the Soviet coup. The hardliners tried to knock Gorbachev out. The first call Gorbachev made was to George Bush. So it was a tumultuous period, the Gulf War, which I haven't even mentioned.
Well, right. So how did his version of personalized diplomacy impact how he was able to carry out that first Gulf War?
It was critical. I mean, look, I don't like to compare and contrast too much, but he had 35 nations, including a neutralized Soviet Union in China for his Gulf War. And part of it was he knew everybody. As vice president, you know, his motto was, you die, I fly. He would go to funerals around the world and meet with everybody. If politics, as Franklin Roosevelt said in a speech he did not live to deliver, it was to be delivered on Jefferson's birthday in 1945, and Roosevelt died on the 12th of April. He talked about how the post-war order was going to be dependent in large measure on the science of human relationships. It's a great phrase, the science of human relationships. George Bush embodied that.
Do you have a sense for what George H.W. Bush's, I don't want to use the term motivation, but why was he, he's not written a memoir himself. What made him want to sit down, I don't know how many times with you, and why were the members of his circle happy to talk with you?
It's a great question. I don't know, really. I can guess. I feel quite privileged that they did it. If you do what I do for a living and a president of the United States gives you his diary and opens his vault and tells his family to talk to you, it doesn't happen much. Mrs. Bush also gave me her diary. She's kept a diary from 1948 forward. She gets up at 5 a.m. every morning, makes coffee, and then writes in her diary. And so the only restriction on the project, actually, there was no right of review. The only restriction was anything I directly quoted from her diary, I needed to get the quotation cleared just because there was so much about the family and that sort of thing. I took her 90 pages of transcripts, and she took nothing off the record. When 43 heard that I had his mother's diary, the exact phrase was, she gave you what? And we ended up okay. We had sort of a rough start, but we ended up all right with 43. Well, first of all, I ask. So I knew the diary existed, and I knew it'd be the last one because of the special prosecutors, right? Obama can't keep a diary. Trey Gowdy would have it, you know. So I believed in this gap I talked about. I believe he is a more important historical figure than he was thought of. And I'm a big believer in to whom much is given, much is expected. I've been very lucky to be able to do what I want to do in my professional life. And so to tell this story meant a lot. And I sort of said that to him. I said, you're not going to like all of it. They knew that. President Bush actually was wonderful about that. I mean, he was like, well, of course not. You know, Barbara, we'd be sitting there sometimes and Mrs. Bush would say, well, George Bush is just perfect. And he'd go, Bar, he's trying to write a story here. You know, he doesn't need to hear that. One of the things I think is important about it is about them right now. And I admire this so much, is they really do think, and they've been, Prescott Bush went in the Senate in 1952. Bush became the Republican chairman in Harris County in 62, ran for the Senate in 64. They've been doing this a long damn time, right? And they are, at least the 41s, incredibly at ease with what they did. They know they got some things right. They know they got some things wrong. And they actually believe in the ultimate fairness of history's judgment.
Author John Meacham recorded on stage at Boswell Book Company last fall. His latest book is called Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. Meacham is the former editor of Newsweek, and he won the Pulitzer Prize for his 2009 biography of President Andrew Jackson.
Next on the show, our automotive contributors talk about the state of diesel in this country on the heels of the VW debacle. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Tine.
And I'm Bonnie North. Diesel passenger cars have had a tumultuous past in the United States. In the last 15 years, they gained some acceptance among American consumers before a more recent downturn. But in the pursuit of increased gas mileage, an increasing number of car makers, from Chevrolet to Jaguar, are now offering diesel models in this country.
But a notable absence is Volkswagen, which once sold the most diesels in this country, but was slapped with a huge penalty for rigging emissions tests results and pulled its diesels off the market.
Lake Effect Automotive Contributors Mark Savage and Dan Harmon focus on diesels in their conversation this month, starting with the extent of Volkswagen's deception.
Yeah, I don't have exact numbers, but obviously they were dirty enough that they would not pass the emissions test if they were not in the special emissions mode. So, yeah, they fudged it and they got caught, and now they're paying something along the $15 billion price tag to make up for that.
All right, well, see, I'm old enough now to know that the damage that GM did to the diesel's image back in the 80s, and now this comes along. Is this more of a black eye for diesels, or is it more of a black eye for Volkswagen?
Well, it's certainly a black eye for Volkswagen. And I think, you know, you might say the diesel has a black cloud hanging over it to a certain degree here. Yeah, GM heard it because they had bad diesels and bad cars when they were making them. And now Volkswagen had good cars and decent diesels, but they weren't as clean as they said they were. And that's, you know, that's that lying usually hurts you in the long run. So, like I say, $15 billion worth of damages as far as paying out to people to buy back their cars and have other cars tested and scrap a bunch of cars and so forth. So it's going to be a little while before diesel bounces back.
What I'm wondering is, even in regular dirty mode, not in the emissions testing mode, which was illegal, are they still, I mean, how dirty were they? I mean, can anyone actually be hypocritical about that and say, well, that's so dirty I can't drive it even though I drive a gasoline car that gets even worse mileage, you know?
Well, it was dirtier, but it wasn't like in the olden days when there was a blue cloud that came out behind the car or truck, as the case may be, since that's where most of the diesels were back in the day and still are. The most diesels have been is 3% of our market in the U.S., and obviously in Europe there it's over half. So that's a big difference. And this hurt Volkswagen there. It hurt everybody. Everybody who has a diesel, it hurt in some way because it does tarnish the image, even though the turbo diesels are much cleaner than they used to be.
I guess I'm getting at here is that they still are much, much cleaner than they were 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. So it's not like they're not a viable option. They just – so I guess are we overreacting to this? And the fact is that they are cleaner than they used to be.
Yeah, still. Well, right. They're cleaner than they used to be, and I don't know that it's necessarily an overreaction because of the size and the scope of this, but – And certainly Volkswagen and Audi, their luxury brand, were the two biggest pushers of diesels as far as in their marketing efforts and so forth. And they had a lot of models with the diesel engines, whereas a lot of the car makers, if they had a diesel, it was in one model or maybe two if it's BMW or a few of the others. So I don't know if it's an overreaction, but it's certainly diesels are viable. Turbo diesels are viable as far as both power and gas mileage, and they can be made to run cleanly, which is what VW has promised to do, is if you're going to keep your car, they're going to make it run cleaner now and back to the way it should have been all along. I think that probably will hurt the gas mileage a little bit, but I don't think it's going to be so much that people are going to be disgusted if they kept their diesel and keep running it.
And also, other European automakers still have diesel options, which are BMW, Mercedes. Oh, yeah. They haven't pulled them out. They are still running these engines.
Right. They're still running them. It's just everybody has to go through the EPA and get it approved. And I know that after this happened with Volkswagen, there was a slowdown in the process because they were testing everything much more rigidly than they had in the past. So I know a few of the Mercedes models were held up as far as when they were going to go on sale in the U.S. So things are still available, but it might have taken you a little longer to get your car a couple months back, and it may take a little longer for some of these in the future. But diesels are out there. They're not going to go away entirely. It's certainly a viable option, but I think that sales of diesels are going to be slow for the next year or two until this kind of gets behind people and into their distant memory banks, not so frequent and recent.
All right. Well, I just find it ironic that at the same time that Volkswagen was discovered to be doing this, the other European automakers that have always had diesels but never in the U.S. all of a sudden were importing them here, mainly because of gas mileage standards. So that's Jaguar and Land Rover / Range Rover now have diesels here, and that's kind of revolutionary, kind of lost in the cloud of scandal, but
Yes, and like I say, a lot of people had one or two, and then maybe a couple now have added a third or fourth version. They may be hoping that they can grab the diesel market, which, like I say, has only been about 2-3% most of the time anyway. So if one German car maker has taken a fall, the other German car maker or two are going to be happy to pick up the slack a little bit and take some of their market share away. I mean, it's a war of numbers and sales numbers.
Okay. So has this hurt mainly Volkswagen, the largest importer of diesel passenger cars anyway into the U.S., or is it an image problem for them, or is it just for diesels in general, passenger cars especially?
Well, certainly has basically killed Volkswagen's diesel sales because they aren't selling hardly anything at this point. But diesel sales overall have fallen throughout all of 2016, and it's way less than it had been in the past. I mean, I think the first one of the months that I looked at, it was like 200 and some units of diesel units were sold in the States as opposed to like 4,000 a year before. So that's a big drop off. I'm sure it's bouncing back some now as we get later in the year. Of course, we won't know those numbers probably for another month or two. But it's, it hurts everybody because it makes you stop and think before you go. You might have thought, hey, that gets better gas mileage. I know these are clean now. I can go buy one. Not a big deal. And then this plants that seed of doubt in your mind. Is everybody doing this? Well, no one else has been caught, so certainly you would assume that no one else was doing this. But it plants the seed of doubt.
Do you have any thoughts that other car makers are doing it?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, most people don't want to take that $10 billion, $11 billion risk. That's a lot of money. And I know Volkswagen had to lay off thousands of their employees over in Europe as their sales have plummeted. So that's a pretty big impact on somebody. And really, I think you and I talked a little before we went on the air here that Chrysler actually has the most diesel sales at the moment. And Volkswagen has fallen off entirely. And, you know, it's Chrysler, GM, and BMW now that are the top ones. Jaguar sells some too. We'll see what happens over the next couple of years. You know, it also didn't help that gas prices dropped way down to around $2 a gallon and diesel was still higher than that. Now that the gas prices have bounced back by at least 25 cents or so, there may be 8 to 10 cents difference. Okay, that's not quite as big a deterrent. But one of the other deterrents, I think, and things that are going to cut into diesel sales is hybrids that are coming along. Certainly, if you want better gas mileage or if you want a cleaner car, the hybrids and then now electrics that will be following that up are another great option and, you know, may supplant the idea that, you know, why do I need to even mess with the diesel or worry about it? I can go with a hybrid or an electric car.
I noticed with Volkswagen, they did pull the diesels and their big SUV, the Touareg, they used to have a hybrid option as well, but that's pulled along with the diesel. Now they only have a six-cylinder option. So do you know why Volkswagen pulled that technology, which they were way late to the game to begin with, and now it's just not even an option?
I'm guessing that they weren't feeling real confident with that technology, and maybe they didn't want to, you know, offer something else up that they weren't quite sure was doing what it should. I'm sure they'll be back because I think hybrids, as we've mentioned many times in the past, are certainly the way to go for the interim right now between gasoline power and electric power, with electric power gaining every year at this point.
And fuel cell technology is actually, it's there. It's just the infrastructure that's not there.
Right. And that's the thing is that in this country, we don't worry about infrastructure till well after the fact. So we're set up well for gasoline. And, you know, if you can plug your car in when you get home, then everybody's good for that. But if you live in a place where you are in an apartment or someplace where it's not easy to plug it in, that then limits that availability. That's why the hybrids are so good, because you can just fill them up with gas maybe every other week and you got, you know, plenty of power to get wherever you need to go.
All right. So do you think then that diesels are done in the U.S. or maybe it'll just stay a truck thing mainly?
Well, certainly the trucks will be, you know, out there like they have been for years. I think diesel will play a role for at least a few more years. I think we'll see the electrics and then the hybrids and both cutting into that. If it was 3% of the market, it's probably going to be 2% this year or 1%, and maybe it'll shrink down to, you know, a few thousand units here or there. But you've got to have a certain amount of sales or you're not going to continue offering it. And considering that the sales have dropped off dramatically in Europe also, some of the car makers may just say, you know what, I'm going to pull back and pull out of the U.S. market with diesel, keep it in Europe where there is a bigger market, and we'll see how it does over there. And maybe in 10 years, if it's still a viable option, they'll bring it back.
Okay. Is there, just one more question, is there anything different about the way that BMW and Mercedes manufacture their diesel engines as opposed to Volkswagen? Do they not have to do this kind of weird wizardry to get false readings?
I'm sure they would be happy to tell you that theirs are perfectly fine the way they are. I'm sure that everybody has to, you know, everybody's got an ECU that electronically controls everything. They must have figured it out well enough that they can pass the tests, both when it's in test mode and when it's in regular mode. Otherwise, the EPA wouldn't allow them to be selling them at this point. And I'm sure that everybody's gone back through a fairly rigid test over the last year and a half since the Volkswagen scandal broke.
All right. Thanks, Mark, for coming in.
Yeah, thanks.
Dan Harmon and Mark Savage are Lake Effect Automotive contributors. Savage writes his Savage on Wheels car review column weekly for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and his website, savageonwheels.com. He's also executive editor of American Snowmobiler Magazine and the editor of Fine Scale Modeler Magazine with Kalmbach Publishing in Waukesha.
Next on the show, Milwaukee author Nick Petrie gets ready to follow up the success of his first thriller with a new title. We'll learn about Burning Bright when Lake Effect returns on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. For someone who is not himself a combat veteran, Milwaukee writer Nicholas Petrie sure gets it. Last year, his debut novel, The Drifter, came out to great acclaim. The book was a thriller and featured Wisconsin native Peter Ash, veteran of multiple tours of duty with the Marines in Afghanistan and Iraq. And while he made it back to Wisconsin sound in body, his mind was less intact.
When the second book, Burning Bright, opens, we find Peter Ash amidst the redwoods in Northern California, still struggling with the PTSD that afflicts him. But that doesn't prevent him from inhabiting another fast-paced story. The book comes out today, and Petrie will hold the launch party at Boswell Book Company tonight, but first, he joins us in the studio and explains how the character of Peter Ash emerged.
My day-to-day life is as a home inspector in Milwaukee, and in 2008, 2009, 2010, I realized that I had all of these clients who were coming back from overseas. And in the course of my, you know, work day, we were just talking about I'm always interested in my clients and where they've been and what they're doing. And I realized how little I knew about what they'd been through and what they were going through coming home.
And these are veterans coming home from Afghanistan and Iraq.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I did what I always do. I'm kind of a chatty guy. So I just ask people questions. And I don't think they knew I was doing research because I didn't really know I was doing research. I didn't know this was the book that was going to come out of that. But I just got very interested and started reading and looking online and talking to more people. And by the time I got to the end of the first draft of The Drifter, I realized this really was a book about veterans coming home. Everybody in the book has been affected by the war in one way or another.
It's interesting to read it because you're talking about somebody who's dealing with the very severe after effects of being in combat, and you talk about it fizzing, and in this character's case, he can't be inside for very long. It really triggers that PTSD, and it's kind of like his way of trying to negotiate all of that and trying to find his way back to it, and yet it's also this amazing. Both books are amazing thrillers and are plotted so tightly. You know that the aftermath is happening, but at the same time, you're just going, okay, what's happening next?
Well, that's exactly the reaction I'm going for. I mean, the goal is to have you care about the characters and what they're going through, but to keep turning those pages because those are the books that I love to read.
Is this the first? The Drifter was the first one you had written?
The Drifter is the first book that I published. I'd actually written three books before that I couldn't find a home for. And in retrospect, I'm glad because it's such a better book than the three previous books. I'm a big fan of that whole idea of 10,000 hours. You really have to put in the time to get better at what you do. And being a writer is not something necessarily for, you know, someone in their 20s. You certainly can. There are lots of gifted writers in their 20s, but it just took me a long time to get to the place where I was telling a story that really meant something to me, that came out on the page the way I intended it to.
When you look at both of these books, both The Drifter and Burning Bright, do you read them and say, okay, that's what was in my head?
Well, I read something somewhere. I'm a big fan of the interviews from the Paris Review. George Plimpton was the editor, so there's this whole collection of interviews with writers where you get sort of the inner workings of their heads and some of the kind of sniping between writers and the jealousies and the plot frustrations. It's a great sort of way to look inside writers' brains. And for me, it just makes me feel a little bit less alone, that I'm not quite as crazy as I think I am. But in one of these, somebody had talked about how your main character should have the same problem that you have. that you're going through right now. You should give that problem to your main character. And in a way, The Drifter was about kind of the three pieces of The Drifter are the recession and the housing crisis and this veteran piece that we've talked about. And for me, the recession was very personal because I run a small business, and which is tied to the real estate industry. And I was following all of the things that were happening. And I also was seeing people put out of their houses. I was a witness to the foreclosure process up close. I'd be inspecting house a day after somebody was moved out by the sheriff. So all of that was happening. At the same time, I had tried to publish a previous book, and all the publishers basically said, you know, we're not going to buy anything for another year because who knows what's going to happen. This was right after Lehman Brothers went under, and everybody thought the world was going to collapse. And the publishers basically said, you know, unless we really know who you were, we're not going to take a chance on your book. And so I sort of felt like my world was closing in, and somehow my character has claustrophobia, which I didn't connect those dots until much later. But, you know, in a way, I think that's how some writers work. And I don't write an outline. I sort of make it up as I go. I'm a wing it kind of writer.
So not a lot of plot planning and all of that. It just kind of tells you where it wants to go next.
Right. Or sometimes it doesn't. But that's part of the process.
Yes.
And Burning Bright, Putnam, which is a wonderful publisher, had agreed to publish The Drifter, and they said, we like this book so much, we'd like you to write another one. And I kind of, okay, sure, yeah, I can do that. And it had taken me about 4 years to write The Drifter, and they wanted the next book in a year, and so. Burning Bright is kind of a road trip book. It's almost a sprint, and that was kind of what it felt like to write this book. I had this opportunity and this freedom to see what else I might do, and what came out is this book that is kind of this wild sort of chase through the West Coast, and it's kind of an exhilarating book, and it was an exhilarating thing to do. It was a lot of fun to write.
Well, it's a lot of fun to read, too.
Oh,
and like
you.
I said, I page, turn, page, turn, page, turn. Even though the claustrophobia is still there, he's dealing with his issues. And you also bring in a character from the first book, Lewis. I adore him. And he's such a great character. And you introduce a new one. It feels like there's a lot more story to tell for all three of these people.
You know, again, I really had no idea what this book was going to be. The Drifter was intended as what's called a standalone, and then I was going to write something else. And they said, no, we really think this would be a great series, and we'd like to see another book. And all I had to go on was this idea that I wanted Peter Ashe, my main character, to fall in love, and I wanted it to take place on the West Coast. So what were the elements that would be involved? And so that was kind of my, you know, June Cassidy is that other, I think, that other character you're talking about. And she's kind of a very strong, opinionated person who is a great match for Peter. And it was fun to do. It was a lot of fun.
It feels like it. You know, it's sometimes as a reader, when I go through books, I can tell when the author's having fun. And then once Lewis came out from Milwaukee to join in on all of this, it just sort of became this huge, wonderful, but also very, very difficult thing. I mean, you're talking about some very secretive, potentially, I mean, this is a fiction, but is it?
Well, it's one of the funny things about writing this book is that part of the research I did early on, I won't say I'm a technology junkie, but I'm really interested in the future. I'm really interested. I grew up reading science fiction. I still feel a little bit of resentment that I don't have my jetpack yet. So I'm interested in all that stuff. And there's the MIT Technology Review is this great online, I'm not quite sure if you call it a magazine or what you'd call it, but it's, you know, it's a glimpse at the technologies that they're working on. And I'm a fairly regular reader of that, and I sort of thought about, so what's something that's just a couple of steps ahead? And between the time when I started writing the book and when I wrote the end notes for the book, a couple of the things that I had thought were, you know, 10 years in the future are actually coming to pass. So it's a crazy process, and that's also, to me, one of the interesting things about writing this book was thinking about technology and how it is kind of agnostic. It doesn't really care how it's used. Medical technology can be used for curing diseases or for creating new ones. Social media can be used for helping democratic revolutions or for, you know, promoting terrorism and demagogues. So it's really a double-edged sword, and I think that's a conversation we're not really having here.
Well, and science fiction, it's fun that you bring that up because science fiction talked about that a lot. I mean, if you go back to Isaac Asimov, he was talking about that in the 40s.
Absolutely.
You know, and you read the stuff in the 40s and 50s, and science fiction was talking about that tension that technology has with a democratic society. And the fact, as you say, it's agnostic. It doesn't care. It just exists.
Well, and I don't know. There's a lot of discussion about artificial intelligence. There's a great piece in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago in the Times Magazine about sort of the growth of artificial intelligence and machine learning and all of these things, which is also something I talk about a bit in the book. And, you know, it's fascinating to think about, but it's a little scary to think about. And so part of this was just I was trying to, you know, bring in some of those things that I had loved when I was a kid and to think about the things that are current issues. And I'm interested in writing about current issues. And one of the great things about crime fiction is you get to talk about everything. It's poverty and wealth and you know, all sorts of stuff. And the best crime writers are really talking about how we live now.
And Peter, your main character, his hands are not clean. Particularly in Burning Bright, you know, there's a lot of consequences of actions that he's done, which in the course of the narrative, you say, well, of course, because he wouldn't be here if he didn't do those things. But those are things that as a society, we tend to look at and go, that's not so good.
Well, and it's interesting when you talk to combat veterans, they may go to war thinking about their country or trying to protect the place they come from, their town or their state. But in the end, and I've heard this over and over and I've read this over and over, they're fighting for the friend beside them. They're fighting for their buddies. And, you know, people do things in war that, I mean, this is one of the sources of post-traumatic stress. And in a way, your brain's rewiring itself. But there's also this cognitive dissonance between what we're supposed to do, you know, what your job is as a Marine or as an Army infantryman or as an Air Force pilot, and what we've been conditioned to do by society are vastly different. And then you get a couple of days conversation, you know, back in the States, and then you're back on the streets. So we're not having that conversation. And it was important to me to show what some of those real consequences are. I mean, I think this is the social issue of our time. It's going to be with us for a long, long time. And some folks are having an easier time getting back to kind of a normal life than others. But it's not easy. The thing that impressed me the most, I was out talking about the Drifter last year, and people coming up to me were Vietnam vets saying, thank you so much for this. I had two women come up to me at an event saying my husbands, or their husbands were in the audience, and the husbands would never come up to talk to me, but they came up to thank me because it helped them think about how to talk to their husbands about Vietnam. And the Vietnam vets who came up to talk to me said, no, it's been 50 years and it's not going away. You know, we are changing lives in a way that it's going to last forever.
Do you think that maybe part of your job as you specifically, not the writer in general, but you, is that you're giving a voice to these folks?
I hope so. I mean, I didn't start out with that as my intention. The goal was to write something that was, you know, fun, that was fast moving, that, you know, would keep you up way too late because those are the books that I love. I wanted to write a book that I wanted to read. But I felt so strongly about the people I'd been talking to, and it just found its way into the book. And it's really the conversations I've been having, and I get letters and emails, and people find me on Facebook and send me messages. It's so moving to talk to people about this stuff. Again, it wasn't something I did on purpose. It just sort of showed up. But it's, I don't know, there's something about it that is really powerful to people.
I think the way you've written it, it takes us into this one particular person's experience, but then makes it universal as well. You know, we can walk, we who have not had that experience can walk in that body. We can embody it for a little while and kind of get a sense of what that's like.
Well, and you know, again, back to post-traumatic stress, one of the real challenges is that people don't talk about it. And it's both the problem and, in a way, the cure, because once you can begin to process that experience with people who've had a similar experience, that is the beginning of the path back. And so, in a way, this is me sort of trying to add to that conversation or to help start a conversation.
Maybe provide a path.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
And again, these two women who came up to me at an event to say this has helped us to have a conversation with our husbands. As a writer, you know, that's like winning the Nobel. I mean, that's a fantastic, you know, that something that I, words that I put on a page can have that effect is fantastic.
So will we see more of Peter?
Absolutely. I'm editing the third book right now. They've asked me for a fourth one, which is sort of rolling around in my head. I'm having a huge amount of fun with it.
Is he going to come back to Milwaukee?
Well, so that's the problem, because part of the DNA of Peter is that he's a drifter. One of the joys is that I get to explore all these new places, and every setting, I'm very interested in setting, and setting is in a way kind of a character, and to go to someplace new is to get to explore a new character. I had such a great reaction from people in Milwaukee to writing a book that takes place in Milwaukee, because there's not a lot of it out there. So I do have something kind of rolling around that would be more of a Milwaukee-based, either a standalone book or a series, just because it's so much fun to write about your hometown.
Sure. Well, I look forward to however all of these characters either interact again or have their own books or whatever. But Nick Petrie, it has been such a pleasure talking with you, and best of luck with this one, and come back for the third.
Oh, I'd be happy to. Thank you so much. This was great. I really appreciate it.
Milwaukee novelist Nick Petrie's latest thriller is called Burning Bright. It is a sequel to his first, the best-selling The Drifter. The book comes out today, and he'll talk about it tonight at a launch event at Boswell Book Company. And that's all for the Tuesday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect. It's on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Keep listening. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.